As I indicated this morning when we studied Psalm 3 together, I want us to look at Psalm 4 tonight, since these two psalms really do go together. It's not absolutely certain that they come from the same incident in David's life, but it's very likely that that might be the case, and if so, it's very helpful to study them together. Appreciate Adam so very thoughtfully selecting psalms for our song service tonight that emphasize various aspects of this psalm. The psalms, of course, were Israel's songbook. And we, I think, especially enjoy the psalms because they are songs. We don't have the music to which they were originally sung in Israel, but this was Israel's hymn book. And so we have a number of hymns that use phrases and thoughts from the psalms, and that's entirely appropriate. Well, Psalm 4 has to do with David's thanksgiving for the help from God that he had prayed for in Psalm 3. And so it has to do with the God who had put gladness in David's heart. I think as God's people, we sometimes have expectations that are too low when it comes to dealing with difficulty. When we face problems, sometimes about the most that we can expect is that God will help us to have courage, just to have enough grit to get through the difficulty. As we saw this morning, and if these psalms come from David's tremendous ordeal of the rebellion of his own son, Absalom, against him, David probably never faced a worse set of circumstances in his life than this. But as we'll see in this psalm tonight, David was able in God to have a good deal more than just courage. He, in this dark hour, was even able to have what could really be called joy and gladness in his God. And so when we're in the midst of some serious ordeal, we need to be thankful that God is able to, even at those times, to help us to have a joy that looks far beyond the sadness and the travail of the things that can happen in the momentary experiences of life. So let's look at this psalm. First of all, in verse 1, there is another prayer by David. If, as we said this morning, Psalm 3 might have been the kind of thing that David would have prayed on the morning after he had to flee from Jerusalem, this psalm may be in the form of an evening prayer that David could have prayed at the end of that same day. Verse 1, "Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness. You have relieved me when I was in distress. Have mercy on me and hear my prayer." David, as we said this morning, knew that he was not a perfect man, but he was a man of integrity, and he knew himself to have sincerely tried to be faithful to the Lord. And he calls upon God here to maintain the justice of his cause. "Hear me when I call, O God of my righteousness." The word righteousness, almost always, especially in the Old Testament, has to do with justice. That which is righteous is that which is just and fair. It's that which is right. And so God calls upon David in the confidence that David's cause is in the right. David, not perfect, but in this instance, he knew that his cause was right and Absalom's was not right, that Absalom was doing an unjust, unrighteous thing. And we need to be able, when we call upon God for help, as we all very frequently need to do, to approach God in the confidence that our cause is just. You don't have to be a sinlessly perfect person to come before God in a specific circumstance knowing that your position in that case is right. That your plea before God is a just plea. If we had any doubts about that, we ought not to be coming before God until we got that straightened out. If we doubt that we're on the side of what's right, we need to straighten that out before we come to God with our petitions. But we need to come before His throne of grace, as the Hebrew writer calls it, as David does here, honestly being willing to call upon God to vindicate our just cause against those who have taken an unjust, unrighteous position with regard to God. And so David calls on God for help, knowing that so many times in the past, God had done the very thing that David was asking him to do right now. "You have relieved me," he says in the second part of verse 1, "when I was in distress. Have mercy on me," in effect, "have mercy on me now, just as you have in the past, and hear my prayer." Just as we need to come before God in the confidence that our cause is right, it's also a very good thing to be able to come before God with a past track record of having been helped by Him in the past, and to approach Him in the confidence that He will yet again do that which He has done for us specifically in past instances. So then with that prayer in mind, verses 2 and 3, we have an expression of David's confidence. First of all, I think in verse 2, David may be looking in the direction of his enemies, headed in this case by his own son Absalom, when he says, "How long, O you sons of men, will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood?" David's enemies were trying to bring down not just another human being. David was the king of Israel, the anointed leader of God's people at that time. And so to do wrong by David was worse than just one person doing wrong against another person. David being who he was, there was a glory attached to his person that wouldn't be the case necessarily for just any of us. And so the sin of Absalom was all the more serious because his dad was not just his dad, but the king of Israel. And what Absalom was doing was turning David's God-given glory as king into shame. And David says, "How long will you do that? How can you dare oppose that which God has set up? How long will you love worthlessness and seek falsehood?" Absalom was doing everything he had done on the basis of lies and misrepresentations. And David, I'm sure, painfully recognized that that's what his son was doing. And he appeals to God for help against Absalom. Verse 3, there were two things David was sure of. "But know that the Lord has set apart for himself him who is godly. And the Lord will hear when I call to him." David was confident that he stood in a right relationship with the Lord, and that as one of God's godly people, God would hear him. We talked a little bit about that this morning, the importance of seeing ourselves as having taken a faithful stand among those who are the Lord's people. If we are a part of the Lord's faithful people and know that we are, then we can be sure that those people have been set apart in God's mind for very special blessing and protection and help. Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 19 in the New Testament that the Lord knows those who are His. "Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal, the Lord knows those who are His. And let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity." We may not, because all we know is just what we can see of people from the outside, always exactly know who is and who is not among the Lord's people as He sees His people. We might sometimes include some people among the Lord's people who aren't, and we might exclude from the Lord's people some whom He sees as being His people. But the Lord knows those who are His. And I believe it's possible, folks, for us to know that we are among the Lord's people. We need to have the attitude that David had, and that is to be open to being shown that there are errors in our lives that we may not have seen at that point, which errors we would be willing to repent of as soon as they were brought to our attention. But we need to have the integrity and the conscience of a David to be sure that the Lord will bless His people And that if we are among those people, then we can be certain that our prayers will be heard. Then in verses 4 and 5, a little bit difficult to interpret in context because they just seem to drop down here into the midst of a discussion, and it's hard for us to imagine exactly how what he says here fits into the context. But he may here be talking to his adversaries. Or, as some other commentators suggest, he may be talking to some of his own friends here, some of his loyal associates who weren't always doing what they should be doing. But whether it was his adversaries or his friends, David says, be angry and do not sin. Meditate within your heart on your bed and be still. David would have learned by hard experience the fact that when difficult things are happening and the nighttime falls, when there are those dark hours, especially those wee hours of the morning, when it's not only dark but it's very quiet and we maybe are by ourselves, strong emotions are especially difficult to deal with at those times. There's a special temptation during the night hours for us to brood over past wrongs as well as present troubles, and for our emotions to carry us away into sinful thoughts. And so whether that's what David is talking about or not, he's certainly giving good advice, isn't he, when he says, be angry if necessary, but do not sin. Anger is not by itself sinful, is it? It is possible to be angry and not sin. But let me tell you, it's very difficult. Anger is fire. And fire can sometimes do good, but it can very easily get out of control and do harm. And it's a rare person who could say, I can be angry and I've got enough self-discipline that I will never let it become sin. Most of us need to hear what David says here, either to his enemies or to his friends. Be angry and do not sin. Paul, of course, quotes that in the New Testament, doesn't he, in his letter to the Ephesians in chapter 4 and verse 26, and adds to that the statement, don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Because it's such a dangerous thing, best to feel that emotion, get the usefulness out of it, keep it within bounds, but get rid of it before the sun goes down. Put a time limit on it, because the longer you remain angry, the much more likely it will be that it will become something very sinful. So in verse 5, then, he has some advice in regard to the key to being confident before the Lord, as David himself was. And here it is. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord. All kinds of sacrifices can be offered to the Lord that aren't righteous. We don't any longer today offer animal sacrifices as they were commanded to do in the Old Testament, but if we can just generally translate between sacrifices for them and worship for us today, the point is still the same. That which is sacrificed or offered or given as worship unto God is righteous or not, depending upon a lot of other things except just whether the bare action itself is what God commanded. In the Old Testament, you could meticulously follow the law of Moses in regard to what was to be sacrificed and how that was to be done, and yet if your heart was not right in the doing of that, that sacrifice would have not been pleasing to the Lord. In Psalm 51 and verse 17, we have an indication of what it is that God wants from those who worship Him. Psalm 51, verse 17, David said, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. These, O God, You will not despise. We come before God offering our worship or our sacrifices with a proud, self-satisfied, full of a sense of how strong we are, kind of an attitude. That's not the heart with which God desires people to worship Him. The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. Paul says in the New Testament in 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8, speaking of prayer, that men are to pray lifting up holy hands. That day and time, Jewish men typically held up their hands to pray. And the point there is, when you hold up your hands to pray before God, those hands had better not have been hands that had shed blood or that had been guilty of doing some harm to somebody else, and you come and you're going to worship God. Those who pray are to pray, and those who worship are to worship as pure people. People who are doing that which is right, and people who, if they have done wrong, have straightened that out before they have come to worship God. So David's advice back here in Psalm 4 is not just to sacrifice, not just to worship, but to offer the sacrifices of righteousness. To come before God and worship Him, not just doing the right thing, which is extremely important, the thing that God has commanded, but to do it with the heart that God commands. Solomon in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 1 talks about the sacrifice of fools. People who just think that God just wants certain kind of actions, and so I'll just go through the routine of performing these sacrifices, and He won't notice, you know, that I'm an ungodly person, or that I don't mean any of this from my heart, or that I'm going to be a hypocrite and go out and do the opposite thing just as soon as I get finished with this sacrifice. That's a fool, thinking that God will be worshipped with that kind of silliness. And so the opposite of the sacrifice of fools is the sacrifice of righteousness. And that was the kind that David would have offered to God. And then he says at the latter part of verse 5, put your trust in the Lord. Sincere worshiper of God, put your trust in Him. It is awfully hard, as I said this morning, to do that. It's easy to say that we do that. But we find out whether we're willing to put our trust in the Lord the first time we face some big decision or some big choice or test in our life where we've got to make the choice between doing what we know the Lord would want us to do and doing something over here that seems to make a whole lot more common sense and seems to be a lot safer. We choose between the common sense, safe path and the path that we know God has indicated He wants us to follow. And we say, in effect, Lord, if we do it your way, it looks like that's the path of disaster, but I trust you enough to do it your way and have confidence that you'll work out the details. That I can't see how that road goes anywhere worth going to, but if that's what you've indicated, then I'm going to set aside my common sense and my human wisdom and my crystal ball that I predict how things are going to work out, and I'm just going to trust that this will be the right thing to do, and I'll be confident in the way that that will turn out in the long run, if not in the short run. So then in verses 6 through 8, we have a concluding prayer by David. He says in verse 6, there are many who say, who will show us any good? Lord, lift up the light of your countenance upon us. You have put gladness in my heart, more than in the season that their grain and wine increased. I will both lie down in peace and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. Verse 6 seems to be a prayer to God to disprove the pessimist that things were not going to work out well. Malachi chapter 3 and verse 14, Malachi talks about some in his day who had gotten so cynical about things that they just were questioning whether there was any point in trying to do things God's way. They just got to the point where it seemed like they thought, you know, everything else being equal, you do wickedness, it's going to turn out about as well as if you do righteousness. And so Malachi 3 and 14, you have said, it is vain to serve God. What profit is it that we have kept His ordinance and that we have walked as mourners before the Lord of hosts? Short term, it can sometimes seem to be working out that way, can't it? All you're concerned about is what's going on right now. You might look at the evidence and say, I've tried to serve the Lord, and what has it gotten me but trouble? David says back here in Psalm 4 and verse 6, there are many who say, who will show us any good? So Lord, lift up the light of your countenance before us. Those who wonder whether it does any good to do good, prove them wrong. Shine the light of your face upon your people in such a way that it will be evident even to your enemies that you bless your people. When he says here, Lord, lift up the light of your countenance upon us, that surely makes me think, whether this is what David had in mind or not, but it surely makes me think of the priestly blessing back in Numbers 6, that the priests of Israel were to pronounce over the people, the Lord bless you and keep you, the Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. David simply praying that the Lord will do that. He will lift up his countenance and smile upon his people and disprove the doubters who question whether it does any good to do good. Then finally, he ends with a prayer of thanksgiving for the safety God provides. He said this morning, David praised these prayers in kind of an unusual way, in that he prays with the assurance that God will help even before he has found out how the situation is going to turn out. He's thankful in advance for answer to prayer. And so he says in verse 7, you have put gladness in my heart more than in the season that their grain and wine increased. You can easily imagine David, if he in fact here is fleeing from the city of Jerusalem, sleeping out on the hard, cold ground, when just a few days before he had been sleeping in the palace of the king in Jerusalem. And now Absalom has taken over the palace and David, the king, is camping out. David's got it hard while the rebel, the usurper, is probably partying back in Jerusalem. And David here, I think, says, Lord, the wrong people have seized the throne. They are banqueting tonight while I am sleeping out here, uncertain of whether I'm going to live or die. But there is a sense in which you have put more gladness in my heart this night than they are receiving from their grain and their wine and their abundance. That's surely the way it is if we've got things in the right perspective, isn't it? You ever ask yourself whether you've got it good in this life? And in answering that question, you look at how you think other people have it, and you see the circumstances in which they live, and all of the winds seem to be blowing very favorably in their direction, and it looks like you just don't have as good a life as they have. Stop and think twice about who has it better. That's not to say that some of those people may not have it very good, even in regard to spiritual things. But you can't tell who's in the better position by looking at who's having a party and who is attending a funeral. The really good things in life, the things that bring joy, are the things that can be ours, even if, from every outward standpoint, as in David's case here, it might seem like things have just gone horribly awry. Absalom could cause David to flee from the city that he'd been used to living in and not be able to live in the palace that he had gotten used to. But there was nothing, listen to me, there was nothing that really mattered very much that Absalom had the power to take away from David. All of that was secure in God, whether David was sleeping in the palace and banqueting or camping out of doors and not knowing what he was going to eat the next day. All of the best things in life are those things that are ours to keep and to enjoy on any day, regardless of the physical things that are going on. So it's an amazing thing, isn't it, when you consider where David probably was and what he was enduring when he said this, to say, you have put gladness in my heart. Said in the beginning, David has a good deal more than courage here, doesn't he? In the midst of a horrible ordeal even has gladness, more so than those who thought that they had engineered a situation where they would have it better than David. And then he ends by saying, I will both lie down in peace and sleep. For you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. Back in chapter 3, Psalm 3 that we looked at this morning, the very last verse of that psalm, he had said, salvation belongs to the Lord. Here he says, I will lie down in peace and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. Paul said it very well in the New Testament, didn't he? In 2 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 12, when in the midst of a hard ordeal, Paul could say, I know whom I have believed. And I am persuaded that he is able to keep what I've committed unto him until that day, come what may in between now and then. And I believe that's the way we need to look at it. So Psalm 3 that we looked at this morning may be a morning psalm, kind of prayer David would have prayed on the morning after he got up, having fled Jerusalem the previous day and gone to bed that night, just having entrusted it to the Lord's safekeeping. And he gets up the next morning and prays Psalm 3. Maybe Psalm 4 is an evening psalm, an evening prayer at the end of that same day. And I think it teaches us how at the end of the day, or at the beginning of the day, we can rest in the confidence that God is God and that all is well. There ought never to be a day, never to be a day when we can't say, all is well with my soul. If we can say that, then it really doesn't matter what else is going on, does it? Learn a lot from David. The more I read David's Psalms, the more I love the Lord and the more I love David. I've come to appreciate him so much from having read these songs that he wrote that were sung by Israel so long ago. It may be that there's someone tonight who needs our assistance in obeying the Lord. If you're here and there's any way that we can help you to do what you know the Lord has commanded you to do in order to be forgiven of your sins, then our help is yours for the asking. You would only need to have the courage to ask us for that help, and we would be delighted to assist you, either to pray with you and for you, or to encourage you, or if you've never become a Christian, to help you be baptized into Christ this very night. We can assist you in obeying the Lord. Won't you come while we stand and sing the invitation song?
When we walk with